Good afternoon, and welcome to the March meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum. Since 1983, we just last year celebrated our 30th anniversary, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service or academia, international businessmen or journalists, talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States, and answer many questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker, Larry Pope. Larry is a 31-year veteran of the United States Foreign Service, an Arabist. He served as a political officer at American embassies in Morocco, Libya, Tunis, and was deputy chief of mission in Bahrain. He was director for the Northern Persian Gulf, Iran, and Iraq from 1987 to 1990, just before the Gulf War. In the late 90s, he served as political advisor to General Zinni at the U.S. Central Command. He is a recipient of the highest award given by the Defense Department to a civilian, the Secretary of Defense Medal for Distinguished Civilian Service. We're glad to have him here today. He spoke, many of you may have heard him last year at the Camden Conference, where he came in at the last minute as the wrap-up speaker and was the best speaker at the Camden Conference last year. So we're delighted to have him here talking about the demilitarization of American diplomacy. Larry.
It's a privilege to be with this extraordinary group. I've been on both sides of this podium, and I can tell you that it's a rewarding experience in both cases. Where I'm standing here looking at a large moose over the Fieldstone fireplace, and for some reason that reminds me of a story about Charles de Gaulle's foreign minister, whose name was Couve de Murville. And Couve de Murville was asked once about diplomacy and what makes a good diplomat, and he is supposed to have responded to the effect that to be a good diplomat, it's not enough to be a damn fool. You have to have good manners, too. I want to talk to you this morning about our diplomatic institutions, not the substance of our foreign policy, which may be a strange choice on a morning when cataclysmic events are taking place in the Crimea. There's an old military adage that amateurs talk strategy, but professionals talk logistics. And the foreign policy equivalent is our diplomatic institutions, our foreign ministry and our diplomatic service, the Foreign Service of the United States. Like other countries, we have both a foreign ministry and a diplomatic service, but unlike other states, we don't take them very seriously. In part, this is a product of our history. We're fond of thinking that we're an exception among nations, somehow different qualitatively from other states. For a few of us, mostly in the San Francisco Bay Area, Cambridge, and the Upper West Side of Manhattan, this means that we're the root of all evil in the modern world. Most of the rest of us, we're given to the notion of the United States as a unique force for good, which is a conviction deeply rooted in our history. The classic 20th century formulation of American exceptionalism is Ronald Reagan's shining city on a hill, an expression which is drawn from a homily delivered by the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, John Winthrop, on the sloop Arabella as they were making their way to the New World. And Winthrop said, "We must always consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us." Now, as Winthrop's flock knew, since the Bible was the essential furniture of their minds, but many of us have forgotten. He was referring to the Gospel of St. Matthew. A city on a hill cannot be hid. His point was that the city they were building would be exposed to the view of mankind and that the stakes were very high indeed, since if their venture were to fail, the result would be to call into question God's purposes, of which they intended to be the faithful instruments. Reagan's warning, rhetoric about, stood this warning more or less on its head. American exceptionalism, the belief that we're different somehow qualitatively from other states, and diplomacy make uneasy bedfellows. One of them is always pulling the covers over to his direction. Diplomacy is a troublesome trope with a wide variety of associations. Before going any further, it may be useful to consider a definition. A useful one for our purposes is the conduct of relations between sovereign states through the medium of officials based at home and abroad. Necessary to it is this concept of sovereignty and the existence of people who speak for those states, whether or not they're part of a diplomatic service. So it isn't really diplomacy when Steven Siegel visits his friend Vladimir Putin, though they may have a common worldview, or when Dennis the Worm Rodman visits North Korea. Tact doesn't have much to do with it either. It may be useful or not, depending, as in all human interactions. But the conventional American diplomatic style is blunt to the point of arrogance and beyond. Not even the best friends of the late Richard Holbrooke, who was one of the most effective American diplomats of his generation, would say that he was a particularly tactful person. Thanks to the efficient Russian secret services, YouTube listeners have been treated to a fine example of this American diplomatic style. When our Assistant Secretary for Europe dismissed our European friends and allies with a breezy obscenity the other day in a phone conversation with our ambassador to Ukraine. I confess to some sympathy with the sentiment, but not with the fact that it was expressed on an open line. The decline of the State Department, our foreign ministry, is an old story in Washington. When Henry Kissinger was the foreign affairs advisor to Richard Nixon, Dean Acheson complained about the number of courtiers he had dancing attendance on him at the White House, eclipsing the work of the State Department. Later, the memoirs of George Shultz are a long litany of complaints about struggles for primacy with the White House staff. Today, that struggle is more or less over. Foreign policy is run not out of the State Department, but by an off-the-books agency of government at the White House, totaling perhaps 300 officials, perhaps more, with various backgrounds. Some of them come from political staffs on the Hill, some from the Academy, some are on loan from other agencies. All are temporary by definition. At the outset of the Obama administration, this body was rebranded the National Security Staff following its amalgamation with the staff of the Homeland Security Council. Last month, its name was changed back to that of the National Security Staff, which sounds better. Press releases from it are issued in the name not of the National Security Advisor to the President for whom its staff works, but in the name of the National Security Council itself, a body composed of the President and principal cabinet officers. Its organization replicates that of the State Department, but it has the inside track since its officials can assert that they speak for the President, and it's rarely worthwhile to challenge their authority. This marginalization of the State Department is compounded by its own internal dysfunction. A widely proliferating and largely horizontal organization chart, which would be the despair of a management consultant. It's the only cabinet department to operate with two co-equal deputies, one of whom is supposed to be in charge of management while the other one handles the politics. This works as well as can be expected. George Marshall's State Department saved Europe from communism with a total of 9 officials of the rank of Assistant Secretary or higher. no deputy secretary, and one undersecretary. There are now some 32 officials of the rank of assistant secretary at the State Department, and in addition, the State Department's website lists a grand total of 22 coordinators, special envoys, and representatives, all of whom are supposed to report directly to the Secretary of State. No wonder modern secretaries largely leave the building, as it's called, as the unlovely edifice at Foggy Bottom is called, to its own devices and operate through a personal staff, staying out of Washington as much as possible. Since the State Department no longer plays the leading role in foreign policy formulation, it has refocused itself on gauzy global concerns located somewhere in the ether rather than in the real world. Of the 75 senior officials on the State Department's website below the rank of undersecretary, an astonishing total in itself, only six, the assistant secretaries for the regional bureaus, are focused on particular places. The rest attend to the welfare of the globe in general. Their purview is everywhere, which is to say nowhere. There are officials in the State Department in charge of global intergovernmental affairs, a global partnership initiative, a global women's issues, global food security, global entrepreneurship, and so on. For a while, Secretary Clinton's special advisor for global youth was the son of Woody Allen and Mia Farrow, who now has a talk show. His job description involved coordinating and enhancing the secretary's efforts to empower, engage, and elevate global youth issues. What can be said about a bureaucracy that believes issues can be empowered, or that it is the job of a junior staffer to improve on the work of the Secretary of State? Now, there's nothing wrong with a foreign ministry that focuses on human rights or terrorism or narcotics or even youth, all issues which transcend the borders of sovereign states. The problem comes when it forgets that everything happens in a particular place in the world. Globalism, as the expression of a generalized human but humanitarian benevolence and overall busybodiness without concrete action in the world, is often a synonym for globaloney. With policy control from the White House, the State Department is left to console itself for its irrelevance with a trendy fascination with social media. Newly confirmed ambassadors now make YouTube videos introducing their pets and their partners to the states where they're being sent. Everybody's encouraged to tweet to beat the band. Our ambassador to Russia, Mike McFaul, a great believer in digital diplomacy, discovered that this can be problematic when, in the middle of a session with his digital network, Russian counterintelligence caught a member of his staff red-handed in a recruitment attempt, suggesting that Putin's FSB has a sense of humor. The problem is a fundamental one. Social media are individual expressions. Diplomacy involves speech on behalf of the state. When officials tweet, one of two things are true. Either they're expressing a personal view, which may or may not be interesting, or an official one. And they're echoing a party line, they're unlikely to attract many followers. If their personal view is at the variance with the official line of the moment, it can only create confusion. Thus, during the preparation last August of the American public for airstrikes in Syria, which the president eventually decided not to undertake, Susan Rice, the national security advisor, was tweeting away in minatory fashion about the critical need for such strikes. Some of this preoccupation with the digital universe and globalism, as opposed to the world of states, reflects the advanced view held in some quarters of the academy, and also within Washington, that in the information age, sovereign states are destined to wither away in favor of the horizontal networks of Thomas Friedman's flat world, a peculiar notion for a foreign ministry. One exponent of this view was a Princeton professor named Anne-Marie Slaughter, brought in by Hillary Clinton to run the policy planning staff of the State Department, the office created by George Marshall, and once headed by George Kennan and Paul Nitze, which is now mostly a speechwriting shop. She had come to the attention of Secretary Clinton with a 2009 article in the Establishment Journal Foreign Affairs titled America's Edge, in which she asserted that in the networked world of the 21st century, the United States had an inherent advantage. And as an example of effective American networking, she cited the 2008 Obama presidential campaign, which had just defeated John McCain. Using a metaphor of billiard balls for nation states, Professor Slaughter argued that in the 21st century, these antiquated entities were already giving way to an emerging network world that exists above the state, below the state, and through the state. In this brave new world, American diplomats would receive instant updates on events occurring around the world, networked counterparts abroad, and be able to quickly coordinate preventive and problem-solving actions with a vast range of private and civic actors, a vast range which would apparently not include other governments. She also argued that women are intrinsically better at this sort of thing than men, which is a plausible enough proposition, perhaps, certainly well one calculated to appeal to Secretary Clinton. Professor Slaughter provided as Director of Policy Planning, a massive reform effort at the State Department, which advanced this view, known for reasons which need not detain us here as the Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review. 242 pages of impenetrable bureaucratic prose, released in January of 2011 to a worldwide gathering of bemused American ambassadors. In her parting comments to the State Department staff, Secretary Clinton cited the QDDR as a major accomplishment. You have never heard of it, for good reason. These days, relatively few of the senior officers at the State Department are Foreign Service officers. The Foreign Service used to run the place as permanent staff under the direction of the Secretary and a few of his political people. Now a dwindling group of career officers coexists uneasily with a temporary political staff which has penetrated down to the office director level. A calculation by the American Foreign Service Association last year suggested that the percentage of Foreign Service officers in senior positions at the State Department had fallen from 61% in 1975 to 24% in 2012. In April 2013, an article in the Washington Post, signed by Ron Newman, the head of the American Academy of Diplomacy, Susan Johnson, then president of the Foreign Service Association, and Tom Pickering, who headed the State Department's investigation into the Benghazi tragedy, was titled, "Presidents Are Breaking the U.S. Foreign Service." It made scarcely a ripple in the Washington pond, though there was some attempt by the State Department to retaliate against Ms. Johnson, who was still a serving officer. It noted the problem of what it called the overwhelming and growing number of political appointees at the State Department. It also suggested that the bench strength of the Foreign Service had been weakened. One consequence of this is that the Foreign Service is increasingly forced to call on retired officers to lead key embassies. In Libya, for a few months, I reported to the wonderful Beth Jones, a retired officer who was acting as Assistant Secretary. The Assistant Secretary for Diplomatic Security was a retired officer, and so on. Would we bring back retired admirals to active duty to run carrier battle groups because we couldn't find qualified active duty officers to do so? There is, of course, the perennial problem of unqualified political ambassadors, and these days, three particularly egregious cases of bundlers of campaign funds appointed to major and demanding posts in Norway, Hungary, and Argentina is being roundly condemned by proponents of good government. Certainly, the Obama administration deserves to play a to pay a political price for these appointments, which reflect a contempt for the office. But the larger problem may be the deterioration of the quality of our foreign service, which still provides most of our ambassadors overseas. If you ask a foreign policy expert these days about the State Department and the Foreign Service, maybe even some of the people in this room, you're likely to get a shrug of the shoulders. Foreign policy is no longer the preserve of a narrow Mandarinate, if it ever was. Knowledge about the world is widely shared. We're all getting a crash course on the Ukraine and the Crimea at the moment. We can watch the horror in Syria unfold in almost real time on our computer screens. Washington think tanks are full of experts on every corner of the world. Some will serve a stint in government, others may work in international organizations, like the International Crisis Group, Human Rights Watch, one of the UN agencies, the US Institute for Peace, and many others. They may focus on one part of the world for a lifetime, while foreign service officers move from place to place every few years. Others, again, perhaps some of you in this room, may have a sense that diplomacy in the old sense is obsolete anyway in the information age. Perhaps Anne-Marie Slaughter's Networking American Diplomats Resolving Conflicts by Remote Control from a Virtual Washington maybe is a fantasy, but isn't there a reduced field for initiative and judgment when instructions can be conveyed via video conference, not to mention email? The argument is an old one. I wrote the biography of a man named François de Callière, who suggested in 1700 that ambassadors ought to be given a degree of independent judgment. The truth is that the world is a big place. Washington is rarely capable of managing more than two or three problems at one time. A chief of mission in full command of his or her portfolio can almost never be instructed sensibly from Washington on a matter of bilateral relations. Much of the work at embassies these days involves not the sending of reports, but the management of programs of other agencies, intelligence, law enforcement, military staffs, which far outnumber the Foreign Service officers, who are a minority at most embassies. In the end, whether diplomacy is still relevant in the information age depends on how we choose to answer a variant of the question Clausewitz asked about war. What kind of world is it? Is it a flat world that we're tending towards, a kind of global hive into which we're all subsumed, or something else altogether? In 1991, a French diplomat named Jean-Marie Guéhenno, who went on to run the peacekeeping division at the UN and who now teaches at Columbia, wrote a book called The End of Democracy. His premise was that the information age would reduce and eventually eliminate the relevance of territory, giving rise to a society which is infinitely fragmented without any memory or solidarity, finding its unity only in a weekly succession of media images, a society without citizens, and thus, in the end, a non-society. It was a particularly French nightmare, perhaps, of fast food and Velveeta cheese. But whether Guéhenno's prophecy of 1991 was right is questionable today. Weekly may be an overly generous estimate of the attention span of the American body politic in 2014, but the world of the information revolution, the information age, is anything but flat. Nationalism thrives as never before as an agent of change. It's nationalism that spurs the occupiers of the Maidans from Cairo to Kiev. Even Islamic radicalism and terrorism can perhaps best be understood as a revolt against modernization of the sort Guéhenno feared. Silicon Valley despises government and all its works. That is, until Google is forced as a condition of entry into the Chinese market to alter its search algorithms and drop its warning that certain sites have been blocked. When that happens, the company whose motto is, "Don't be evil," cites China's sovereignty as an excuse for violating its own principles, while international bankers compete with each other to hire the princeling children of China's communist elite. It's also notable in this globalizing landscape that the U.S. is often the odd, with its networking edge, is often the odd state out. From Kyoto to the Law of the Sea Treaty to the International Criminal Court, the U.S. is often an outlier, rejecting any compromise of its own sovereignty. The U.S. Senate has recently distinguished itself by rejecting an international treaty on the rights of the disabled on the most frivolous of sovereignty grounds. The consequence of this information revolution may have been to undermine the authority of the state, but at the same time it works to reinforce cultural and political differences. Scotland will hold a referendum later this year on whether to abolish the 300-year-old monarchy union which created Great Britain. Frustration grows in Europe with Brussels. China and Russia make regular use of the veto in the Security Council. The U.S. uses the veto to block the censure of Israel, whose Zionist ideology is a classic 19th century nationalism. The Palestinians want a state with a territory, not a website. We are a long way from a world of Velveeta cheese. For the United States to exercise leadership in this rapidly changing landscape, which is emerging before our eyes, will require agility, fast footwork, experience, and a realistic sense of the possible. One word for this is diplomacy. In the aftermath of Iraq and Afghanistan, disasters which have wasted our treasure and the lives of our young, there is a danger, I think, of that we'll indulge in a retreat from the world. That would be a disaster. If we think about the last 50 years of world history, and indulge in a thought experiment in which we remove the United States. It wouldn't be a free Europe and thriving and democratic Europe. No democratic South Korea, no Israel. The world would be a very dark and a very different place. And so as we look forward to the world of the 21st century, this isn't the time to retreat from American leadership. And to do that, to avoid doing that, will require a rediscovery of our diplomatic institutions. Secretary of State Kerry's father was a Foreign Service officer, of course. He has said that watching his father in action taught him the value of diplomacy. The State Department's website says that at the end of 2013, he'd been overseas for a total of 161 days since his swearing in on February 1st. Dealing with the likes of Sergei Lavrov and Bibi Netanyahu will leave him little time for institutional reform. Real change will have to start with the president, who seems content with things as they are, though I think for my part that he was right when he told an audience at the National Defense University last May that unless we discipline our thinking, our definitions, our actions, we may be drawn into more wars we don't need to fight. Reforming our diplomatic institutions will have to reflect a discipline of our thinking about the world of states. Before I turn to your questions, comments, and objections, let me say something about the Foreign Service, assuming I can do so without indulging in the sentimentality, which is one of the besetting sins of old age. I'd been out of the business for some 12 years before I went to Libya after the murder of Ambassador Stevens, Sean Smith, Tyrone Woods, and Glenn Doherty. I volunteered to go out only until the end of the year, and I was very glad to get back to Maine. When I arrived in Tripoli, the staff was traumatized. General meeting, I told them that anyone who wanted to leave could do so without penalty. In the end, very few did. But after the meeting, I took a particularly able and dedicated officer and the staff back to my office, which also served as my bedroom. And I said, that offer doesn't apply to you. He stayed. I won't repeat his response, but he's still there with our very able ambassador, Deborah Jones. They, like Foreign Service personnel elsewhere in the world, assume a degree of risk in order to advance our security interests, often at real personal sacrifice. And we would do remember this, which is why my little book is dedicated to the women and men of the Foreign Service of the United States. Thank you very much.
Okay, while we're getting questions, I'll ask the first question. Larry, what would you do to change this? Or I'll rephrase that. How in the world can Washington, the way Washington is now, correct this problem? Because I don't think Washington cares. I mean, I think it's only Foreign Service officers that are aware of how weak our diplomacy is.
My premise, the premise of this little book I've just published, which I neglected to plug, it's called The Demilitarization of American Diplomacy, is that 10-point plans to do that, as you suggest, yeah. Mac, are unlikely to be effective. What's needed is a change of thinking about the outside world. We indulge in a kind of extraterritorial, two kinds of extraterritoriality, if you will. One of them is sort of a vague sense of general benevolence, in which we make ourselves responsible for righting every wrong in the world. And the other is our military power and our activities increasingly in cyberspace. Both of those are a mistake. But until we come to terms with the nature of the 21st century world that's emerging, still a world of states, rapid change, the impact of the information age, certainly. But in the end, the need for the United States to exercise leadership within that system of states, we won't have the kind of diplomatic service and the kind of foreign ministry that we need in order to manage that change.
Okay, here's a follow-up on technology. The world, and thus diplomacy, increasingly involves requiring understanding of science and technology. Is it still appropriate, therefore, for the U.S. Foreign Service to focus on hiring generalists?
Well, we need to hire the best people we can find, whether they come out of Silicon Valley or our finest universities. They need to have a thorough understanding, I would argue, of the way in which information technology is changing things. They may not need themselves to be IT experts. Maybe more important for them to understand the way in which information technology is changing the world than to be writing computer code.
Is there anything practical you can recommend to mitigate the problems that you refer to of incompetent political appointees as ambassadors and the resulting falling Foreign Service officer morale?
The American Academy of Diplomacy has a project on the professionalization, the professional issue involving diplomacy, and I'm a part of that in a small way. But I think, again, that the quality of our diplomatic institutions and our foreign ministry reflects the way we look at the world. It's a function of our own sense of who we are and what we intend, and also of an over-reliance on military power around the world. I didn't get a chance to address that. Time is short. But until we correct that, those thought processes, we're unlikely to have the diplomatic service we deserve. But when we do, it should be possible to it shouldn't be beyond the ingenuity of the American people to ensure that we have one.
This is a question that quotes Andrew Bacevich, you know, the retired colonel. Apparently, there was a piece in today's Bangor Daily News in which he asked, I think it was the same piece that he wrote last week, I saw in the New York Times, what do we need an army for? His answer is, we need it to defend the country. We don't need it to do anything more. What's your response to that? And the questioner says, is the army, even with the cuts anticipated or proposed, is the army still too big for what it should be doing?
I'll say two things, I guess. One is that there is still a need for American military power in the world. Think for a moment about if we were to remove American military power from the South China Sea, what that could lead to in terms of a struggle between China and Japan and the Philippines and others. So there, the United States is playing an appropriate and an essential balancing role, and there's really no substitute for American military power. We have wildly overextended ourselves in Iraq and Afghanistan. The consequence of those excesses is we're going to be paying for a generation to come. But I think the greater danger is a withdrawal from global responsibilities than, and I think that is sort of something that confronts us at the moment. There's a revulsion in the American public over what's happened to us there, and it's understandable. But American leadership is going to be critical in the 21st century, and you only have to look at the headlines to see the degree to which it remains relevant. And sometimes it has to be buttressed by military power.
All right. Here's a somewhat related question to the whole issue of our lack of expertise about what's going on outside our borders. When I travel overseas, I see so much more information about international issues. Not so here, where precious little news in our newspapers are on our TV news channels in the evening. With this as the case, how do we hope to change?
Well, I'm tempted to say that groups like this are sort of a bit of an antidote to that. But I think, we are engaged in the world. Our citizens are engaged in the world. And I'm struck by the number of young people who are interested in international careers. There's a tremendous, my own daughters are thoughtful people when they look at the outside world and deeply concerned about it. So I wouldn't be pessimistic about that side of things. And the information revolution has given us all access to these images about the outside world in a way that sort of confronts us very directly. It's hard to turn our gaze away from Syria. It's hard for us not to think about Ukraine. So we're drawn into the world, and I think that's going to continue to be a feature of our politics.
Okay, how about this? If you were a young person, and this kind of relates, you were referring to your daughter, possessed of the interests that you had 40 years ago in diplomacy, foreign policy, what avenue of service would you pursue today? Would you still go into the Foreign Service?
Well, there are so many ways that young people can get involved in international life. I do think that the Foreign Service is a very small bureaucracy, something like 7,000 or 8,000 people in the officer part of it. We'll always need good people doing that, and I guess I would say that in the end, the country is probably at some point things may have to get worse before they get better.
Oh God!
But as they do, I have some confidence in the good sense of the American people, and presidents and secretaries of state will eventually take corrective action, and when they do so, they'll find young people who are dedicated and committed, as much as or more than we were when we entered into the State Department. And so I wouldn't be pessimistic about that at all.
Good. Glad to have some optimism here. All right, here is, we've got a couple of questions related to technology. I'll sort of read them both and you can answer them as a unit. How should we be using digital technology? How to combine time-honored foreign service practices with digital technology?
Well,
follows
a good
up. And here's the other one.
Yeah.
Do you see a way for technology to become a positive factor to advance diplomacy?
You know, in Libya, we were very proud of the fact that we had 100,000 followers on our Facebook page. Now, I wasn't always sure exactly what the point, what that was doing for us. But it isn't a bad thing at all. It isn't a bad thing at all. It gives us a way to reach out to people. At the same time, diplomacy is still essentially speech on behalf of the state. Now, if that's multiplied in the digital universe so that the message reaches a larger population, that's a very good thing. But if the message is obscured by sort of conflicting tweets by officials who are in favor of bombing Syria and some who aren't in favor of bombing Syria, that's not a good thing. It's appropriate for embassies and the State Department to use Facebook and Twitter and all the rest of the apparatuses of the digital age to reach a population, but it's not a substitute for thoughtful action, some of which has to be private, to advance American interests. And sometimes that involves sitting down and talking with people rather than bombarding them with messages.
Okay, here's another one relating to sort of training and personnel. We've trained thousands of Peace Corps volunteers in local cultures and local languages. How many of them were effectively integrated into the Foreign Service, and why weren't more?
Well, you know, Betsy Pope is here with me, and we're both former Peace Corps volunteers. But it's not a good idea, I think, for the Peace Corps to be seen as a farm team for American diplomacy. That would undermine its independence and its purposes. That said, I know a lot of folks who eventually transitioned from the Peace Corps into government service of one kind or another, and that's a good thing.
Okay, I've got one question about Congress. U.S. diplomatic efforts are often obstructed by congressional or other political action. Would a stronger diplomatic corps help change this? And if so, how do you get one?
You know, diplomats are a creature of politics and certainly not above politics. It's true that sometimes having 535 secretaries of state speaking all at once confuses the American message overseas, but that's something we have to live with in our democratic system. The old adage that, you know, politics stops at the water's edge is honored in the breach more than the observance these days. So it's an inevitable part of our democratic system, just as it is the democratic systems of our allies. It doesn't prevent the Brits and the French and the Germans and many other countries from having effective career professional diplomatic services. When the confirmation process for ambassadors is used to advance a particular partisan agenda and it involves career officers, that's obviously damaging to the whole system. But it's inherent in our system.
Okay, and here's another one that sort of relates to the political aspect I was just asking about. Remember Eisenhower's concern about the military, warning about the military-industrial complex. Now we seem to have added politics to the military-industrial complex. How can we, you know, make this more effective? How can we make our country more effective from a diplomatic point of view?
Well, there are a lot of things in that question. The military intelligence complex is sort of the modern version of the Eisenhower's old warning. We doubled our spending on intelligence broadly since 9/11, doubled our military budget, more or less, even in light of the sequester and proposed cuts by Secretary Hagel. We have special forces officers in more than 100 countries, and when we're doing one thing or another, that's a lot of people out there doing some training, doing some other stuff. We're very heavily engaged in the world. We've got a new cyber command headed by a four-star officer who is both head of that military command and head of the National Security Agency. It's a rather remarkable concentration and power. We haven't come to terms with the whole issue of cyberspace. We are engaging in offensive operations in cyberspace in a way that tends to militarize it. And it's only a matter of time, and indeed other countries already are retaliating and operating in the same way. And it sometimes occurs to me that we may look back on this period of the information age as a golden age before the cyberspace became a battleground. And that's something that diplomacy needs to address. It isn't something we can address simply using offense. It's something that eventually needs to be grappled with as a diplomatic problem, so that we're engaged in other states, and we're a long way from doing that.
Okay, we're gonna sort of narrow the focus a little bit. This is a transition question. Do religious and ethnic conflicts increasingly trump nation states?
It's a complicated issue, isn't it? I suggested that Islamic transnational, if you will, Islamic radicalism was in part of a response to the sort of pressures of modernization and the information age. I think it's difficult to see the outlines of the 21st century clearly, but I think as they emerge, we can also see some things happening. One is that old nationalisms, long buried, are coming to the fore as people and groups reassert themselves against the fear of being submerged in Gehenna's, you know, indigestible murk of globalism. So that's happening on one hand. On the other hand, it's undermining the authority of states and authoritarian states, because they're no longer in a position to exercise a monopoly over the information that their people receive. And the result is, you know, Tahrir Square or the Maidan in Kiev. But I guess I would emphasize that those populations are acting not in pursuit of a sort of digital utopia. They're using digital methods and social media in order to advance what are often nationalistic purposes. The crowd in Tahrir Square chanted, "You're an Egyptian, raise your head." And the same thing in Kiev. It's Ukrainian nationalism that is the cause of the crowds gathered by social media in the Maidan. So I think it's a complex picture, but it's certainly not we're certainly not moving in the direction of this globalized, flat information utopia that sometimes Silicon Valley would tell us, would persuade us we're moving towards. It's much more complex than that, and it's a world in which we're going to need fast footwork, agility, the ability to understand situations, react to them appropriately, gather allies, and take assertive action and exercise American leadership. And the word for that is diplomacy. My only argument about this is that we need institutions that are good enough to enable us to do that.
All right, we're going to end with three questions about specific countries. we'll ask, the first one's about the last country you were in. What chance does Libya have to create a stable, coherent government to move, the question says, to move beyond the current clash of factions and regions?
Well, the Libyans have taken, I guess, two steps back and one forward over the last year or two. Militias haven't been disarmed. They are more powerful than ever. The state pays them out of oil revenues, which amount to some $60 billion a year, so it's not a problem of money. The state isn't coalescing. There was a kind of agreed myth when I was there that somehow the Libyans could be saved from the outside and that the outside was going to do that, and we tended to agree on that with the Libyans. It is a myth. Eventually something will have to coalesce inside Libya, to which most Libyans can give assent. It's complicated by the fact that it's three rather different pieces of territory. In the interior, the Fezzan, in the west, Cyrenaica, in the west, Tripolitania, in the east, Cyrenaica. So, and they're very different, and they have very different histories. They were cobbled into a modern state in 1951 in a plebiscite, which was run by the UN. So that sense of nationhood is weak, and it'll be a while.
Okay, how about this one? This is about Saudi Arabia. Apparently, the new ambassador who's going there, Joe Westfall, is a Mainer.
Indeed.
What advice would you give your fellow Mainer about dealing with Saudi Arabia?
He's not a Foreign Service officer, but he's a very good choice.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I want to say real quickly about all of this is that none of what I've been sort of savagely critical, I guess, of the organization of the State Department, but I don't mean to be critical of the individuals who are working there. Think about, for example, Sarah Sewell, who's the Undersecretary for Global Affairs, just confirmed, whose father was a lobsterman not too far from here, and is a great person. Or Rick Barton, who some of you may know, who heads the State Department's Crisis and Stabilization Bureau, who's from Booth Bay Harbor. We have lots of dedicated people, and Joe Westfall would be, I think, very much among them, and he has a background in the Pentagon, which suits him very well to deal with the Saudis. I guess, I don't know. It's a gerontocracy, isn't it?
It sure is.
I would urge him and his staff to remain alert to the prospect of sudden change, even as they deal with the Saudi monarchy as it is.
Okay, we've saved the best to last, or the most difficult to last. If you were advising Secretary Kerry, what would you advise him to do in terms of the Ukraine and Crimea and Russia at this point?
You know, we'd have a long discussion this afternoon about that. I guess to try to answer it seriously, the ground on which we stand is our European allies. So whatever Tory Nuland was overheard to say about them, we need to get past that and recognize that if we act as if NATO and the Europeans act with us together forcefully, that's the best chance we have for changing Putin's mind about what he's done. That, I suppose, the turning point in all of this is Germany. And that, therefore, there ought to be a lot of talk in the next few days with Angela Merkel to ensure that we develop a common, solid understanding of what we're going to do going forward. Again, it's diplomacy kind of writ large. There, we need a forceful response, which is a non-military response. There are lots of options. We do have to be a little careful, I think, not to trigger Vladimir Putin's worst instincts, which he's indulging right now. So that's an inadequate, once again, response to a very good question.
Well, listen, Larry, it's been great to have you here. Unfortunately, we were unable to get copies of your book to be available for sale. But what I think we'll try to do is have them available next time we have a meeting.
Well, that's great. They're available on Amazon.com and both in the ebook version for your Kindles and Nooks and anything else of that kind, and in the hardcover. It's a short screed. of only 90 pages, and I hope some of you at least will buy
it. That sounds great. Hey, many thanks, Larry.
Thank you. Thank you very much.